Shall I begin? Right, well, thanks very much for having me here. Very little time left, so I'll start without further ado. As I was going to present some more recent results of our small group in Liverpool, but to do that I would have to set the scene and remind some results that have been already presented. Some of you have already seen that have been published a few years ago. The basic philosophy of what I will be talking about is that, it's a mostly mathematical study, so we're dealing with equations, with the models, not with any experiments at all. And the equations of cardiac models are very difficult for numerical simulations, and numerical simulations are what is mostly done to this equation because they are complicated. But they're very difficult because they have small parameters, and the time scales of various variables are very different from each other, and that makes it necessary to do the very small time steps in calculations, and that makes the calculations very, very expensive, and so whole heart sort of realistic geometry calculations for now are outside the reach of the best supercomputers as yet. So there is a computational challenge, that's on one hand. On the other hand, all applied mathematicians know that if you have small parameters in your models, that should help you rather than be an obstacle. It could help you if you just use asymptotic methods to simplify, to use these small parameters to simplify the models and to get simpler equations which don't contain small parameters anymore. Therefore, they should be easy for simulations. In some cases, when you have when you apply those asymptotic methods, you may even get some analytical results. That is something you can get a straight answer without further use of computers. So, shouldn't this be done for cardiac models? It hasn't been done largely for cardiac models as yet, although the cardiac equations are around for, 40, 50 years. And, the reason is that the small parameters that we have there, they are rather confusing. And it takes a bit of effort.
You turn the microphone on?
I don't know. There was a gentleman here.
Yes, it's on.
It is on, yeah. So the way the small parameters appear in the equations are rather confusing, and the attempts to use a standard asymptotic methods to these models have been not very successful. There were several attempts and some results, but what I've just said, that small parameters should be used to reduce the computational load, that hasn't been implemented yet. So what's the problem? The problem is that the small parameters are very unusual in cardiac equations. So the first thing I will be talking about is what are the correct small parameters, how do we identify. And then there will be just some examples of applying these ideology to concrete problems, to conduction block problem and the initiation problem, and in the end, if I have time, I will say a little bit about spiral and scroll waves and where all that can be applied there as well. So the first part about the asymptotic structure is a mostly reminder where are the correct small parameters. This is a reminder how the typical mathematical model of cardiac excitation looks. That's just a small part of it. The rest is hidden behind this notation. It is some of the equations. You no doubt seen all of this. They are very complicated. Dozens of variables, hundreds of parameters. So is it possible to simplify at all? Well, the answer is hopefully it should be possible because there are encouraging examples. There is a Fenton-Karman model. There's been a more recent model by Panfilov and others. And they try to reproduce rather realistically, maybe not all, but selected an important property of realistic models, of detailed ionic models, and they only contain 3 to 6, say, variables. And so this success makes it sort of, makes us hopeful that, well, it should be possible to do to any model. Well, you just need to develop regular methods to do that. So how do you do regular methods to do this kind of thing? We will start with the very simplest models, Hodgkin-Huxley model and Noble 1962 model. They have very similar structure. Of course, Hodgkin-Huxley is not a cardiac model. Noble 62 has very similar structure, and it is a cardiac model. And this is the simplest representative of the models, which are based on experiments. Whether they are correct from the modern point of view or not is not particularly interesting. Important is that they have a correct structure. So what are kind of simplified models are considered most popular? This is the Fitzhugh-Nagumo model. As already has been mentioned, that this model is could be sort of derived from Hodgkin-Huxley equations. That is true. That's what Hodgkin and Huxley did in their work, and then Fitzhugh-Nagumo sort of developed on that and everything. They've kind of derived a system from four-variable model, a system which looks similar to this. However, the interesting property of this system is that it has analytical results in the limit when this epsilon is much smaller than this epsilon, and what is derived from Hodgkin-Huxley does not have that property. And more importantly, of course, Hodgkin-Huxley is not a cardiac equation. So whether or not Fitzhugh-Nagumo is actually a good simplified model for cardiac excitation remains to be seen. We believe that it isn't. The reason why we believe it isn't is illustrated here. So why this Fitzhugh-Nagumo system is actually very popular is partly to do with this fact that I was mentioning the smallness of the parameter. This epsilon is much smaller than this epsilon. This allows one to apply so-called standard singular perturbation theory, fast-slow systems, inner solution, outer solution, this kind of thing. You may have heard about all this, even if you're not a mathematician. And the result of applying this methodology to this particular Fitzhugh-Nagumo system is this description of a propagating pulse, where you have a very sharp front, then very smooth plateau, and then very sharp back of the wave. That is just a snapshot of a propagating wave. Wave propagates to the left. And what is interesting, I believe, for applications is not just when this excitation wave propagates, but when it stops propagating. Because when the wave propagates in the heart, normally nobody cares. Interesting problems start when they don't. So does the Fitzhugh-Nagumo describe this propagation correctly or not? So what I will do, this movie shows the propagation of the wave. The blue wave, the blue line, shows the excitability. So initially, excitability ahead of the wave is suppressed, but it is only temporary. And after some time, the excitability is restored. So in these two movies, this excitability is restored at different moments of time, and we'll see what will happen. So here, excitability has restored just before the back of the wave approached the block place, and so the wave has recovered and it will propagate happily ever after. Here, excitability is restored a bit later. Oops, sorry. Here, the excitability is restored a bit later, after the back reached the block site, and well, the wave doesn't recover, it has been blocked. So from this description, there is a simple criterion that the wave will be stopped if and only if the back will catch up with the front, and that's the whole of the story. And that's what can be sort of explained in terms of standard perturbation theory applied to the Fitzhugh-Nagumo model. For comparison, let's have a look what happens in a more realistic model. That's a Cortemanche Ramirez Natel model, 1998, of human atrium. So is a one-dimensional fiber, rather big, so to hold the whole of the action potential, propagating action potential. So that's the propagating action potential. The setting is the same. This is the excitability, which is temporarily suppressed here, and then it is restored. See, we have restored excitability much earlier than the back of the wave caught up with the front, but the front did not recover. The wave has been stopped. So it's nothing in common with what Fitzhugh-Nagumo predicts. So the theory based on Fitzhugh-Nagumo is completely inapplicable to this kind of phenomena. Right, so we need to identify what are the correct small parameters in our model, in cardiac models, and use them to build the correct asymptotic theory rather than the wrong asymptotic theory as in Fitzhugh-Nagumo. So how do we identify them? Now here comes a very crucial place. This is something I have to say, because if I don't say it, then what I will do later may seem as trivial and obvious to some people and absolute nonsense to other people. So just to be on the safe side, I will say it. The experimental models don't contain parameters in the mathematical sense. They contain constants, something that has been measured experimentally. Well, they do sometimes contain parameters, that is something that is kept constant but can be changed, say concentrations of ions and that kind of thing, but mostly they're constants. So when you're talking about asymptotic methods need small parameters. Small parameters, something can be it is a constant that can be changed and it can be set to arbitrary small values. In experimental models there are no such things. So when you say that we are dealing with a small parameter, that means that you artificially introduce that small parameter. You say, okay, I have this constant, it is small, so therefore I will replace it with the letter epsilon, and I will consider epsilon going to zero. That's what you do. But it is an arbitrary procedure. Mathematically, it means that in the functional space describing the model, you, instead of one point corresponding to the particular model that you consider, you consider a curve with a parameter changing along that curve, and you consider the limit along that curve, and that's the limit in which you derive all your formulas, but the actual original problem corresponds to only one point in that line. And of course, as you can draw infinitely many lines for one point, there are infinitely many ways you can introduce small parameters in your model, and that is always an arbitrary procedure. So whether or not this is reasonable can be checked. And the answer is actually depending on what kind of solutions you are interested in. So if you are interested in propagating waves, then perhaps you should check that when you introduce the small parameters, then when you get that parameter smaller, these propagating waves still behave in a way that you expect them to behave. So there's a kind of regular and easy procedure. As long as you have mathematical models and you can simulate the solutions, you just change the parameter, make it smaller and smaller, and see if the solutions behave reasonably. And if they do, then, well, that's a good parameter, then you can start analytical work. That's what we have to do. But otherwise, introduction of small parameters is always arbitrary. This is not a limitation of what we do. That is what is always done. And that's why I needed to tell, just to say it. Now, I'll try to keep the amount of formulas to a minimum. So instead of writing many formulas and asymptotics here, I'll just list it assumptions sort of in a physiological language. The assumptions that are made, so fast sodium current, activation gate M is very fast. Inactivation gate is relatively fast, but slower than M. Then goes fast sodium current itself. It is, of course, very large, but it is only large when the gates are open. So when the gates are closed, it is not large. It may be comparable or smaller than other currents. So these two things, how do you reconcile them mathematically? Well, you have to take into account the fact that the fast sodium current gates are near perfect switches. That is why when they are open, this thing is large, and when they're closed, this thing is small. So this is the fact that they're near perfect switches is very important, and without it you wouldn't get a correct asymptotic description. Now, why does it require mentioning perfectly, separately? That's because what does it mean to be a near-perfect switch? For instance, for the M-gate, it means that the quasi-stationary value of M-gate for a voltage smaller than a certain voltage, say minus 35 millivolts, is practically closed. Well, practically closed means that if we consider asymptotic limit, in that limit we have to say that it is exactly zero. M infinity is exactly zero for the whole range of voltages. And mathematically that is a rather unusual thing, because when people talk about generic systems, it is not normal for a generic function, for the right-hand side in the generic system, to be zero for a whole range of arguments. That's absolutely out of order. But that is very essential for, as we see, for description of cardiac equations. So we have to take this step and step away from the standard asymptotic theories in this place. So if we want to base our models on the realistic asymptotics of realistic equations, this is what we get. And the equation that we have here is a result of applying this ideology to the Noble system, Noble 62. There are lots of formulas, but I hope I can easily explain it all. This theta function is the Heaviside function. It is zero when V is smaller than Vm and one otherwise. So then when voltage is below Vm, that is this thing, this is the voltage axis, this whole right-hand side here is zero. I'm neglecting the diffusion, the electroton for now. It's just a single cell description. So below this line, voltage doesn't change because, well, the fast sodium currents are closed. This is a fast subsystem. That is what happens in the during the upstroke or onset of the action potential. And therefore, all that relates to slower processes or smaller currents is just neglected. That's the limit in the fast time. So in the fast time, voltage below this line doesn't change at all. So if we plot with the red color, all points on this plane H, V, all points where the right-hand side for V is zero, the voltage doesn't change. It includes this line where voltage is equal to the reversal sodium potential. It's equal to zero at this line where the H gate is closed, and it is zero in the whole rectangle, in the whole area. It's half a stripe. In the whole area where voltage is smaller than Vm, because there the M gates are closed. That's very unusual mathematically, because mathematically in the generic system what you normally would have would be lines. But here we have an addition, the whole yes.
If you were to leave the normal thing instead of being zero, this would be very small.
Yeah. Yes. This would be very small, and some, perhaps somewhere here it will be exactly zero. Because if you are left with something which is very small, that you haven't done your job yet. You're not ready, well, you're not considering the limit, asymptotic limit. You still have small parameters. And that's what we set our goal to get systems without small parameters. So it's very small means it's zero in the limit. That's what we do. So this unusual feature, and that unusual feature necessarily follows from, well, the properties of cardiac equation. And for H-gate, it is more or less usual. This is the H-infinity as a function of voltage curve. For simplicity, we replace. We consider that H actually is zero for voltages greater than a certain VH. Again, it is actually small when A V is greater than certain V H, but we want to replace small things with zero, so this is zero here. So this blue line represents the points where the right hand side for H is zero. So the intersection of the blue set and the red set should be the fixed points, the equilibrium where both V and H are stationary. And this intersection here, you see, it is everywhere where the blue line goes. It goes through the red area, so therefore every point along the blue line is actually an equilibrium. If it is actually an equilibrium, that means that, well, these equilibria are not isolated from each other, which is a mathematically, again, a peculiar thing. What this means physiologically, I will explain. If you consider what corresponds to normal upstroke trajectory, you have voltage above Vm to ignite the, to open the sodium channels, and initial H should be somewhere between 0 and 1, so that you have your current. So this is a typical trajectory, or this is another typical trajectory, or this is a typical trajectory. So you have upstroke of the voltage from some point above Vm, and it ends with H equal to 0, that is when the inactivation gates of the fast sodium channel close. One important feature here is that depending on where you start, you can end up at different points. You can end up here, 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 here. Well, that's because you have so many equilibria. Well, what does it mean? It means that, well, first of all, the voltage at the very top of the action potential will be below E and A. And second, it may actually depend on H. In particular, if you introduce the electrotonic effect, so you consider not a single cell, but a tissue or a fiber, then you can get voltage at the top of the action potential different from what you have in a single cell. That's the property of this idealization, of this parametric embedding, of this description with the small parameter. But you, of course, know that, what happens in cardiac models, single cell, is action potential has a different upstroke than in the propagating tissue. This is not the case in physiognomia. In physiognomia, it always will be the same thing. If we were to reinterpret this as a physiognomia system, this is where it always would end. So the physiognomia limit here is when we assume that V voltage is faster than H. Well, and of course, if we don't replace small things with zeros, as Vasson has suggested, then it will be the physiognomia limit. In that case, the voltage in the end of the excitation front will be always the same. But this is not what happens to cardiac equations. So this is for normal model. We will see a bit later that a very similar thing appears for Corti-Munch model. So this part of the description appears rather universal. This fast subsystem is more complicated than the fast subsystem that you get in the physiognomia system, but still it can be solved analytically, although the answer is a bit longer than in physiognomia. The other part of the asymptotic procedure is to describe what happens after the upstroke, the slow processes, so the limit in the slow time. This in a normal system is a more traditional thing. In fact, this particular system of equations has been obtained by Krinsky and Kokoschka in 1973. What they did, they simply discarded fast sodium current. Well, this transient. And of course, what they obtained is the result of the system, which is perfectly correct, but it describes what happens after the fast upstroke. And now the slow variables are N and V, voltage, and the gate for the potassium current. There are, as you know, there are no calcium currents in Noble's 62 model. And the structure of this model is rather traditional. The null clients, they are more or less physiognomia-like, and in fact, if you consider, introduce a second small parameter and consider that this variable is slower than this variable, then it will be perfectly physiognomia-like system. But that is another small parameter, which is not as small as the first one that we considered before. And of course, what happens in the slow system is very much dependent on the particular model, so it will not be the same in all systems. Of course, in Noble's model, there is only one slow variable N, and in Corti-Munch model, there will be much more of them. Now, we return back to this phenomenon of propagation block, how it happens in realistic ionic models. So to see on a qualitative level what kind of solutions you can get with this approach, what we have done, this is the fast subsystem that we've considered before. Of course, N remains constant during the upstroke, during the propagation front, and this is the right-hand side. So there are some functions of the voltage. Here we replace those functions with constants. This is another function, we replace it with the constant. Another function, we replace it with the constant. The H capital, by the way, is the value of the H gate, quasi-stationary value for... Yeah? First of all, it would be wrong because it's actually slower in the Nobles model. And, in Hodgkin-Huxley it's the same. But Nobles is much slower, it's 100 times slower. So it would be wrong. Second, it would not be convenient because, it would be three variable system rather than two variable system. Okay, so when you do that, this is the system of two equations that you obtain. Reminder that theta is a Heaviside function. That means theta has the value 1 or 0, depending of whether the argument is positive or negative. So at any range between minus infinity to VH, between VH and VM, and when everything is greater than VM, you're dealing with linear systems. So therefore, it's a relatively simple task to see what kind of solution you can have. And indeed, if you just ask the question, what kind of propagating fronts you can find in this model, remember, it only describes front, it doesn't describe the recovery because we have neglected slow processes, so it's only front. This is the kind of solution you obtain. H is a constant before the front, and it just decreases exponentially, and the voltage first increases exponentially, and then it approaches its ultimate value exponentially.
We published this in 2002. It's exactly the same equation.
Very, very good. And I also published in 2002. It's exactly the same equation, exactly the same solution.
Yeah, it's just matching to a linear exponential tail, and you get the square root. Yeah.
Yes, very good. Now, the properties of this solution exist not for all values of variables. One very important thing, I don't know, did you have it there in 2002 or not, is this V minus. That's the voltage before the front. Now, in the approach that we have adopted, it can be anything which is lower than VH, in principle. Because when you have V smaller than VH, your system is in equilibrium. In this particular formulation, your system is at equilibrium. And you can consider wave propagating through a system which has voltage before that, which can be any voltage. It doesn't have to be resting potential. That's one arbitrary parameter that we have here. And of course, you still have parameters in the equation, and the equation, you have two parameters as they're written here, but it's very easy to see that actually the product of these two matters, so you can actually rescale the system to get tau equal to 1 or j equal to 1, depending on your taste. In this particular case, it was rescaled to get tau equal to 1. So j is the parameter, j is a its physiological meaning is the availability of fast sodium channels, or the maximum amplitude of the fast sodium current. So it appears that for any given value of V minus, you need to have excitability greater than a certain minimum, and then for all those excitability values, J, you can have two solutions, which is fast and large front, and the other which is slow and small front. And it appears that the fast and large is stable and the slow and small isn't stable. But this all only continues certain J mean. It cannot go anything below it. So what corresponds to it in the Fitzhugh-Nagumo? It is that, if you find any analog of excitability there, then this is the kind of curve that you will obtain. So, in fact, you can continue it further. So you can have negative speed. Well, negative fronts with negative speed corresponds to wave backs. And so it's perfectly possible to have a wave front going ahead, then stopping and going back, or resuming. It doesn't disappear. Here, if the wave front is forced to propagate any slower than this speed, then it, well, it just can't. So something should happen to it. The answer is the propagation will be blocked.
You know, if you look at FitzU in the limit where there is no separation of time scale between the path and the stall variable, you recover the same.
But of course,
it behaves like FitzU. So yeah, basically.
Yes, except in FitzU. Yes, yeah, of course, you're right. Except in FitzU, you have the pulses; they have front.
Yeah. So it's a question, but is the limit of FitzU that looks just like this?
It's not a limit, as you say, you don't separate the scales. Yes, if you consider FitzU, it will be just like this, except you have pulses there, here you have fronts, that's the difference. So in FitzU, yeah. Now what you...
I agree.
What is done here, the excitability has been changed not to zero, but to some sub-threshold level, and then restored. And you have seen it is... was sufficient to stop this difference between good and bad excitability is rather small, as because we know theoretically from analytical formulas where it is somewhere here. So we were able to predict quite accurately what is necessary to stop this wave from propagating. This is in this two-variable simplified model of the front. That's the analogy. It's somehow I like it because I only recently learned to drive the car, and I know that if you choose the wrong gear, it can just stall, and then regardless of whether you press gas or brakes, it doesn't go any further. So it's just what happens here. So it's a stalling here. If you drive a car and something in front of you, another car, runs too slowly, you have to switch the gear, otherwise the car will stall. That's what happens to this front. That's the analogy. Right, okay, so that was an introduction to the simplified models. Now, does it apply to more realistic models? What we have done, we analyzed the Cortimanche 98 model for the human atrium tissue. We have roughly considered what are the speeds of various variables. That's the formal definition of the speed of the variable by the inverse of the diagonal element of the Jacobian of the right-hand side. And well, that's a definition that gives tau exactly the same tau as we have for tau h, tau m, tau n, and all the gates, but also allows one to define tau for the voltage. And so you can roughly separate well, the greens are not very visible as usual. These are the greens, taus of greens of slow variables, which are in green, then taus of faster variables, which are in blue, and tau of the voltage, it kind of wanders between them, which is in red. As we have seen in Noble's model, actually, depending on the stage, it can be fast or slow. During upstroke, voltage is a fast variable. During recovery, plateau, it was a slow voltage, a slow variable, so that's what it behaves here. So rough separation. This time scale is logarithmic, so to see both what happens on a very short time scale and a long time scale, and that was drawn for a typical action potential solution. So we just identify that some variables are fast and some are slow, and what kind of equation do we get then? This is how the system of equations looks after that. The small parameters that have been introduced by this procedure are shown now in red. This just signifies what happens in the limit to the M bar and H bar, the quasi-stationary values of M and H gates. They are contain this factor that makes them exactly zero in certain ranges of voltages. And if we consider the limit, well, there are actually two small parameters here, epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. And epsilon 1 actually separates superfast variables like M gate, and some of other gates also are superfast. And when you just retain what corresponds to the small parameter epsilon 2, fast time, then you, the system of equations you will get will have this phase portrait, which is very much similar to what we had for Noble 62 model. Here it is not as stiff as there, in the sense that H and E and voltage are not so much different than speed, so you can see quite clearly that different initial values of H will end up in different finite values of the voltage. So the voltage in the end of the upstroke of the action potential actually depends on what happens during the upstroke of the action potential. That's very, it's very much more true for Kortemansch, because Kortemansch is not as stiff as Purkinje fiber model by model, by Noble. Right, so now we can start trying and can draw some useful conclusions from all the theory. So far it was all theory, so what can we do useful out of it? So what we have done, we have analyzed this Kortemansch model in the limit of small epsilon, and we try to see if we can, not qualitatively but quantitatively, study the solutions in the form of propagating fronts. This can be done analytically, but the answer is very ugly, so it's more worthy to do it numerically. It appears that to have a correct answer, or reasonably accurate answer, you need to include M variable into consideration. So it's actually a system of three variables, M, H, and the voltage. And the answer qualitatively still is the same. There are three parameters. The voltage before the front, here it's denoted V sub alpha. The excitability parameter J, which in Kortemansch model has a literal sense of the J slow inactivation gate, and the speed of the front as a function of the two, and for every value of the prefront voltage it has this folded curve shape. And if you project all possible values of J and V alpha, all these curves, onto the plane V alpha J, this is the area where any propagation is possible. So for V and J above this dotted line, propagation is possible. Below and to the right of it, it isn't. Propagation of a front. Two parameters that govern, that make a decision. So this is again the same plane, only it is now in two dimensions, not three dimensions. This is the voltage, this is the J variable, and this red thing is the boundary where the propagation is allowed. So what we want to achieve is a kind of simple, as simple as possible, a criterion when your propagating wave in realistic simulations, two-dimensional, three-dimensional, or at least one-dimensional, when actually a wave will stop propagating. Is it possible to predict? Because, well, in the Tsunoguma theory, there is a simple, very simple a criterion which tells you when it will propagate, when it not. Can we hit a similar criterion here in realistic equations? So far, if you just look at this red curve, the criterion is not very simple, and it is term of two variables, this pre-front voltage and the excitability J at the front of the propagating wave. Fortunately, it appears that it should be possible to simplify this problem further, because what these blue lines mean, these are the traces of the action potential, or the ends of the action potential corresponding to various initial values of the variable J. So what we did, we initiated various action potentials with different values of J in the beginning, and they all return to the equilibrium, which is somewhere there, along one and the same curve, very close to each other. Which means that in the slow system of this model, there are still some further small parameters that tell us that, well, these curves will be attracted to some super slow manifold. Now, what exactly this super slow manifold is, and what are that small parameters, it is a question that is still being investigated. We have some preliminary answers, but I'm not prepared to sort of publish them yet. But whatever the reason, the experimental fact is that when you're dealing with a normal action potential, then J and V in the tail of it will depend, will change synchronously along one line. So when you want to decide whether or not propagation will be possible, it's only enough to see when that line will enter the area above this red curve. That is when this common trajectory actually crosses this red line. So before it crosses, the propagation of the next pulse is not possible. After, it is possible. So this point represents the boundary of absolute refractoriness. And as you can see from this magnified view of this intersection, you can determine this boundary with rather good precision based on this analysis of a three-variable model, which doesn't contain small parameters. Three-variable model, M, H, and voltage. It predicts that this value of pre-front voltage and this value of J at the front will be the margins of the absolute refractoriness. That's the prediction of the theory. Now we have tested that prediction in numerical experiments, which will be illustrated here. The color coding is a red component of the color that's here and here represents voltage. Initial condition is that it's very sharp, it's high voltage here, low voltage there, but otherwise it will be gradual. And the blue component, which is here, it represents the area of absolute refractoriness, that is where J is smaller than J star, the critical value. So the prediction is that if and when the front of the excitation, that is the boundary between black and red, will ever reach the back of the refractory zone, there and then you will have conduction block, breakup of the wave. That's the prediction. Now these blocks, I've depicted them in yellow, and they will appear in these moments of time. Just watch here. Here's one. Here's another. Next one will not come soon. So the prediction actually has two sides. One is that when it reaches, the block will occur. When it doesn't reach, the block will not occur. So when we see that it rotates and doesn't break, it's still a confirmation of the prediction of the theory. So watch for 3:37:40, it will be soon. There will be another block, and then shortly after that, another block. This one. This one. Okay, so the direct numerical simulations seem to confirm the prediction of this asymptotic theory. Whatever. I wanted to just remind you what you have seen last week on the Otani's and Salama's talks. This is a kind of phenomena that they considered unsure. And Niels's talk is simply took as a assumption that the certain diastolic interval, which by the way is characterized by a certain speed of propagation and everything, is a measure which can predict whether or not a next wave will stop. Now, in this kind of approach, we try to not to assume it, but actually to derive it and derive it numerically. And Salama's talk, you just remember that some of the model that he shown also showed the wave breaks spontaneously occurring. So it would be interesting to check if this theory can describe them as well. That's still the thing to do. Of course, the theory will have to be modified because that's a completely different model. So the question is whether it will have the same asymptotic structure is open. Yes?
Supposing you took the simplest situation, which was just a one-dimensional paper,
yes,
and you periodically paste it,
yes,
at one end at different frequencies,
yes,
does your analysis describe
what will happen?
Does your analysis describe what happens?
Yes, thank you. Very, very, very good question. We so far have done half of that work. We describe how the front will move. Yeah. Apart from that, we also need to describe the action potential which will ensue after that.
Yeah.
And that's what we haven't done yet. That's in the progress, the work in progress.
Decremental conduction.
Yeah. The decremental conduction in this language that's used, decremental conduction is the same as the wave breaks that we have seen. So this approach doesn't really, I can show it again. It doesn't really distinguish between sort of true break, which leads to generation of new spirals, and the break after which they subsequently reconnect, as here. Well, this is a point of the break, and now they will subsequently reconnect. That's kind of decremental conduction in your definition, I suppose.
But
we don't distinguish in this, yeah.
Yeah, so the reason why I'm asking the question is that in many experimental circumstances, for example, pacing the atria at different frequencies, you develop patterns of block, which in the heart are called Winky Bat patterns.
Yes.
Where you get different rational number ratios.
Yes.
Of stimuli to conducted.
Yes, of course.
Patients. I wonder if. Here's a numerical simulation.
Yes.
Suppose you just did a numerical simulation in a one-dimensional case.
Well, it would be possible to do one-dimensional, of course. Yeah, it will just not so nice.
No, well,
but yeah, perfectly possible.
The
yeah.
Question is,
yes.
from a point of view of the rhythms that you get, exactly what would the rhythms be?
Right.
In terms of.
Yes.
Patterns of excitation and patterns of
yes, yes. I think I understand your question. I try to explain my answer once again. I think what you want me to do has already been done by Neil Sotani. So there are two parts of this description of how the fronts move and what happens between the fronts. Now, how the fronts move is described by the theory, well, in some approximation, with some assumption, but it's described by the theory. In particular, it describes when the fronts stop moving. And that's what the prediction that we have just checked. Now, what happens between the fronts is to be answered by a different set of equations, the slow system. And that is what we have done but haven't published yet. And we only have done that for Noble 62, but not for Courtimanche. For Courtimanche, it's a more complicated problem, hasn't been done yet. The answer is we don't know yet. But if you assume that all the regularities there will be the same as you obtain from simply experiment with the action potential, when you draw the action potential restitution curve, if you just postulate that it will still be true, then the kind of theory that you will get will be exactly what Niels as shown. So our sort of small contribution here is that instead of just assuming that, well, there is a certain diastolic interval after which the propagation is not, or if the before which the propagation is not possible, we just say not diastolic interval, but it's, well, J variable, we can measure it. And if you change your model in such a way that J changes differently, then we can say that, well, this still will be true, although the diastolic interval course will be different. Well, that's a contribution from our theory so far. Well, there's still a lot to do. Yes?
Well, this is a comment and a question to both Niels and you. In the remodeled myocardium, post-myocardial infarction, which is what I work on, there's a phenomenon called post-repolarization refractoriness, where the DI interval is really not terribly related to excitability because you don't necessarily, you have complete repolarization before you have the cover of excitability. So you had a graph there with your repolarization.
Yes.
It will
have different shape in that system, of course, yes. It will be something like this, I suppose.
And every action potential can be a little bit different. So the DI, you can measure it, but it might not be related to the degree of excitability. So
yes.
We have a J gate in our cellular model.
Yes.
Because we have been able to biophysically measure the contours of recovery at slow.
Yes. So you have a cellular model, mathematical model.
Yes.
So instead of checking for diastolic interval, you can check for the values of J, which values of J associated with the breaks. Will they be varying or will they not?
We measure the current, and we measure its recovery, and measure the H gate, and things like that.
Yeah. So you can directly check this kind of prediction without actually doing all the
work.
Simply check the value of the J variable the values of the variable are the places of the block. If they are all the same, if there is a correlation between J and block, is it directly testable if you can measure it in your numerics or your?
Able to measure J on a cellular model.
Yes.
cell basis in the antenna.
Well, not experimentally, but if you say you have a mathematical model, then you can check it in numerical experiments. Well, in the way of just show.
Are you thinking that both J and H are important?
Clearly, in the remodel by but it's the phenomenon has been described for a long period of time in arrhythmias post polarization refractoriness, particularly in the ischemic myocardium that sets up the original beat. And yet nobody had a biophysical concept of what that really meant. And now we see that there is a remodeled sodium channel that actually leads to that post polarization refractoriness.
So it's not just elevation of resting potential that slows down the recovery from inactivation?
No.
So it's a remodel.
It's a change in the sodium channel function by physical properties.
So it has a slower recovery from inactivation.
Yes, right.
Some particular J and H may be remodeled?
Yes. And what? Why? What molecular mechanism? Why is there a J and H? Is it hyperphosphorylated or whatever? We don't know that quite yet.
Is that beat to beat, or is that beat to beat, or it takes
actually time? What happens is that, and I won't bring these data, but the remodeled myocardium is very frequency dependent, high, and accumulates the channel in the inactivated state. So it's more likely to find that block, the loss of excitability, but it has nothing to do with the repolarization because the action potential is shortened. And that was my point about...
Yes, and that might mean that the asymptotic structure, as a mathematician would say, there is different, actually. So it may or may not be applicable. It's worth checking.
This might not exactly be the correct way to predict threshold.
It's worth checking, nevertheless. It's worth checking, nevertheless, I would think, if it is easy to do and shouldn't be difficult in numerics.
There's a comment following what Alan was saying in the model that we have with Alan. That's the way we used to calculate the minimum. I mean, when we fit to a particular conduction velocity curve, we want to calculate what is the minimum DI. Basically, we calculate the J such that we get a conduction bump.
Right. Right. So you also got it that J is a kind of predictor of.
J is the one.
Yeah.
And that's an important thing also. When describing how EADs propagate or not, and that's one of the reasons it's very hard for an EAD really to propagate in tissue. Perhaps there are special conditions in order to have these EADs.
Yes, Johannes.
They get all close and open again a small amount of tissue size.
Okay.
Can you show the graph of conduction velocity versus excitability? You have two branches.
Yes.
Is there any experimental evidence for the lower branch?
Wait a few minutes. I'm not an experimentalist. I'm a theoretician. You will see theoretical evidence. Okay. Shall we continue? Right. It's just a summary. What are we thinking of doing next to it? As I said, we need still to describe the action potential shape in the slow time, and then we combine the two to get a phenomenological description of what happens in terms of front propagation and then slow recovery, and that's the kind of the model that Niels was using, and that's kind of almost done for Noble 62. We are now in process of writing paper, but for Courtemanche that's still some work to do, although it has been started. And well, it should allow, of course, ab initio derivation of restitution curves, and in particular resolving the phenomena like whether there is or there isn't memory variables in a particular model, and if there is, what is the nature of the memory. Hopefully this kind of approach should clarify all that, but that's still plans to do. Now the next topic, completely different, is rather than block of propagation, it is initiation of propagation. So there are various ways to put the problem mathematically. You can inject certain current during certain time into a fiber and see it will initiate propagation or not. Or you can raise a voltage in a certain length and see to a certain value and see if it will initiate the propagating waves. We prefer the second because it's simpler mathematically. So this is the one-dimensional cable. This is the voltage and also the time. So we depict time plus voltage. So when it propagates, you see it going up. So initially, it's a rectangular pulse. And if it is wide enough and high enough, then it will give rise to a propagating wave. And if it isn't wide enough, then it just decays or high enough. So if X stim is this length of the stimulated region and the U stim is the amplitude, then in the plane X stim and U stim, you have a critical curve. So above that curve, you have initiation success, and below that, it's a failure. It's a very well known thing experimentally for a long time. Now, starting point was that there exists a theory of this kind of event for Fitzhugh-Nagumo, and I will start from that theory. And the suspect was that the cardiac equations may be a bit different, but whether they're the same or different, we need to investigate them separately because they're not like Fitzhugh-Nagumo. So, that's the point where this new simplified model of the form propagation could be helpful, and that's what we used it for in this study. So first, the standard theory of initiation and Fitzhugh-Nagumo. It actually starts with initiation in a simplified version or the fast subsystem of the Fitzhugh-Nagumo. It's a fast equation where the slow variable is simply frozen, and this equation is known as Zeldovich-Frank-Kamenetsky, also sometimes referred to as Nagumo equation. This is a simple equation. It describes propagating trigger fronts with this now theta is a number, not a Heaviside function. Apologies for confusion. So what is known for this equation? For this equation, there is a so-called critical nucleus solution, which is a stationary solution. That's when this thing is equal to zero of this equation. Now, this stationary solution, it is unstable. I didn't think of actually drawing the picture, but perhaps that's how it looks. Also, it's symmetric. That's described by this formula, exact solution to the system. So if you have excitation everywhere above this critical nuclear solution, initial conditions, then you will get excitation waves. Well, of course, they will propagate both ways. If it is everywhere below, then it will decay. If it is neither, then the question is more complicated, although it could be resolved still. But important thing is, mathematically speaking, what is essential there is that this critical nucleus solution is unstable, but it has exactly one positive eigenvalue. I can't avoid speaking here mathematical language, but I'll try to explain what it means on the next slide. So if you have only one positive eigenvalue, that means that the codimension one stable manifold. If it's a codimension one stable manifold, that means it separates all the phase space into two regions, two domains, and you cannot get from one to another without crossing that manifold. So that manifold serves as the threshold between excitation and decay. Now, to make all this gobbledygook slightly more comprehensible, I've used this picture from the paper by Pricing and Krasovska, 1997. So what they did, they've used the Golovkin approximation. They considered solution of this kind. There's exponentials, decaying exponentials, times certain coefficients. The width of this bell-shaped curve is given by the coefficient k, and the height is given by this coefficient a. So what if we consider that solutions that more or less are described by this kind of curves, where a and k change in time? And that's more or less standard mathematical procedure. You can sort of do this and that, and then minimize the errors, or there are other formulations. What you get in the end will be the system of just two equations for a and k, ordinary differential equations, phase plane analysis, very easy to analyze. they did additional assumption. They considered very small theta, very small excitation threshold in the cubic polynomial, and this is the phase plane that they have obtained. So the critical nucleus on this phase plane corresponds to this point. The complete decay corresponds here. The successful initiation corresponds to curves, the trajectory is going that way, where A parameter increases. So this point corresponding to the critical nucleus is a saddle point. That means that there are two trajectories exactly that approach it, and two trajectories exactly that go away from it. These trajectories are called separatrices, and the meaning of these two trajectories is particularly clear. These separatrices, they separate the part of the phase plane which corresponds to decay. All the trajectories from here will meet to decay, and this part which corresponds to excitation, all trajectories here will go to excite the excitation wave. So these two trajectories, they make a exception. If you check your initial condition at this trajectory exactly, then what you will see in the long run, you will observe this critical nucleus, the unstable solution. Well, you may say that it is an exceptional event, but if you are interested in the question, what is the boundary which or margin between successful excitation or failure, and you say change one parameter like this amplitude of the initial stimulus, then you're considering different points on this phase plane as initial conditions. So if your initial condition, if your initial points are to the left of the separatrix, it will decay. If its initial conditions to the right of the separatrix, it will be excitation. But in the way, you inevitably will have to cross this line.
But I don't understand. Yes. Because if you're talking about propagation, you're talking about things in space.
Yes. 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 It's yes, of course. Well, it's all projected to this manifold.
The answer to this question.
So the answer to this question is that the trajectory. Yes.
In space.
Yes.
So I don't understand what you say lies on one side of the other side of that line.
Yes. Yes. I'll draw the answer, if you allow me. That will look approximately like this. Each of these curves is described by this formula with various k's. What we observe first, your A, it grows. What you have then observed then, your k decreases. So this, the width of the bell increases. So the propagation in space corresponds to decrease of k. The growth of the excitation corresponds to increase of A. In this particular limit, this decrease in k is not seen, but eventually the curves will go like this. That corresponds to propagation in space. Well, you have to believe me, because, well, that's what they published, and...
Wait, so you're saying that the shape of the pulse is that function?
Yes, 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 yes.
Oh.
So it can be narrow or can be wide. So propagation corresponds to this bell getting wider and wider and wider.
But in general, you want to know whether an arbitrary initial condition will propagate or not.
Precisely, yes, yes. So in this particular formalism, what you do, you have to project your initial conditions to this manifold. That's approximate the best way you can by this function. And after that, just find where this point on this phase plane is, whether it's to the right or to the left of this line, and you're done. The initial point, your initial condition, suppose you have your initial condition, you have to approximate it with this bell-shaped curve. This bell-shaped curve will have a certain A and a certain K corresponding to it. On this phase plane, A versus K, you take the point corresponding to it. Then the theory, whether it's correct or not, is another question. It predicts that it will then change according to this, go along this trajectory, and will get to decay. Well, if it is to the right of this line, it will now go to the excitation.
So I'm interested in a problem where I have a wave propagating.
Yes.
And I give a stimulus sometime after the wave propagated.
Yeah, it's a different problem. It's a noise, Plesnik and Krasovska theory. It is their theory, that's the authors. I'm merely quoting them to justify the approach. No, it is. It doesn't. It only considers. No, it's more complicated. You will have to do a more complicated ansatz to describe what you're suggesting. Yes. A of t and k of t given one shape. Well, a square is not good because, well, the right-hand side... Yes, probably you can. Yes, there is a procedure. It's just projection. You choose the norm. Yeah. When you choose the... Well, what is here is a two-dimensional manifold in the functional space. You project on it. Well, you choose the matrix and you find the nearest point and that's it. Yeah, it's very well defined. Well, if your manifold is reasonable, yes.
How do you project on that?
Well, this has been obtained just projection in L2. The average. No, you don't. You just use the norm. Well, the projection can be defined as the nearest point on the manifold. That's it. That's in principle. That's enough. Yeah. Well, that's what they did. Well, they actually did something else. They minimization. They used the gradient form of the equation, but it's equivalent. Right. So that's the ideology. Now, this line is therefore is very important. And what is important that if you have one parametric family of initial conditions, that is, you have this shape, and you have the possibility of raising it up or down, then at a certain point, you will observe the following. Your initial conditions will arrive at the critical nucleus. In real life, you never can be absolutely on this line. So what will happen? You arrive near the critical nucleus, will stay at it for some time, and then depart either to excitation or to decay. That's the prediction of the theory, what should happen. And that's, of course, what is observed. Now, that is only projection, two-dimensional projection, two parameters. Important thing is that if we consider the whole phase space, then instead of this line, what we have is a co-dimension one manifold. That is, it will be a hypersurface in the functional space, which actually does separate here from here, excitation from decay, and whatever you take initial condition on that surface, you will inevitably arrive at the critical nucleus solution, stay near to it for some time, and then depart. If you choose your amplitude of stimulation close enough to the threshold, that's the prediction of the theory. Now, I won't dwell on this simple case more. Instead, I'll just consider Fitzhugh-Nagumo. That is, I introduce the second equation. Now, I consider this is a finite epsilon, small but finite, and this V is present here. And if I ask the question whether this equation will contain, will have critical nucleus solution, then it's easy to show that if we are dealing with an excitable system, rather than say bistable system, then there are no critical nucleus solutions at all. It's not possible. That doesn't matter what the exact shape of this. It doesn't have to be cubic. Important is that there is only one true equilibrium in the system. So you must have something instead. The answer to that question is known. You don't have a critical solution as a stationary solution, but you have pulse. Well, you have a propagating excitation pulse, as you have in Fitzhugh-Nagumo system, but you also have unstable propagating pulse, which, by the way, happens to have one positive eigenvalue, exactly one positive eigenvalue, and mathematically, that means that its co-dimension one stable manifold will be or can work as a threshold between excitation and decay, and that is a prediction that is easy to check numerically. And that means the following. If you check initial conditions with the amplitude right at the margin of excitability between successful excitation and decay, what you should observe, you should observe that your initial condition will evolve towards this unstable pulse, be at near to this unstable pulse for some time, and then depart to excitation or to decay. That's the prediction. If this conjecture is true, that's what should happen. This is the result. We've tested that with just initial conditions in the Fitzhugh-Nagumo. We're taking as a very narrow and high pulse, or lower pulse but wide. And the left column is slightly below the excitation threshold, and the right is slightly above the excitation threshold. And the excitation threshold has been determined with high precision. I think it was 7. Or maybe even more significant figures. Well, the difference between this and this 7th significant figure in the amplitude of the stimulation. So what we see here, there is some propagating pulse, then it decays. Here we see a similar propagating pulse. Well, then it develops into higher propagating pulse. This and this are the same. So this is the unstable pulse. Here it decays. Here it develops into proper excited excitation stable pulse, and this pulse is the same whether you start from narrow and high initial conditions or from broad and low initial conditions. So regardless of initial conditions, as long as you choose the amplitude close to the threshold, the unstable pulse is what you get. This is the answer to your question. Who did answer the question? You, Johannes, you did. Yeah. So whether it's, well, that's the evidence. So you inevitably should observe it if you choose the amplitude close to the threshold. But that's in Fitzhugh-Nagumo. Why such a big difference between Fitzhugh-Nagumo with non-zero epsilon and the previous case where epsilon was zero, where we had actually stationary solution? The answer to that is that, well, this unstable pulse actually, for small epsilon, it actually is very small and actually propagates very slowly. So in the limit, it becomes that stationary critical nucleus in the limit of epsilon zero. But nevertheless, for non-zero epsilon, it does this. So we have a propagating critical solution instead of propagating, critical nucleus stationary solution. So we can expect that perhaps we can observe something like that for cardiac models. So we start, of course, with the simple model, although we know something about it already. So again, it's easy to check that there is no critical nucleus solutions here. And again, it is known that there are unstable fronts, and those unstable fronts have exactly one positive eigenvalue. And so again, there is a conjecture that codimension one stable manifold of that unstable front will be the threshold. So the only difference is instead of critical pulse, we have a critical front here. So this picture illustrates the confirmation, numerical confirmation of this conjecture. The upper row designates solution above threshold, slightly above. This is slightly below threshold. So what happens here? It's not very well seen in this time resolution, but it was a problem to see all things, development of the fast font and what happens in this transient period. So what we did, we plotted each font, its shape. We moved it to a certain position so that one point of the font where the voltage is Vm. No, VH, doesn't matter, at a certain position, to zero. So all fronts are shifted to one position, so you can compare one with the other. And of course, since we know the exact solutions for propagating fronts in this model, we can compare that with them. So the slow solution, the unstable front solution, depicted by green, which hardly appears here, but it is here. And the stable solution, supposed to be blue, but it's actually magenta, is here, a stable front solution, and the red lines fronts in between. So what we see here, that originally we observe lines here, front profiles here, then they evolve, and the profiles here, there are many of them, they overlap with each other, and they correspond to these profiles. That's what happens in the successful propagation. In the unsuccessful propagation, again, initial profile shapes are near the theoretical slow profile, and then they evolve to more and more gradual distribution, and in the limit that probably will be a constant. We also checked how this point where the voltage has a certain chosen value moves in time, and here is plotted the velocity or the speed of this point as a function of time. And of course we know that for the exact solutions, for the unstable front, the speed solution is this. For the stable front, the speed solution is this. And what we see is initially the speed solution is here, and then it switches to here. That corresponds to the transition between here and here. That's for successful propagation. As for the unsuccessful propagation, the initial speed is here for some time. It's quite a long time, 200. And then it goes down. So it stops propagating. Right, so this is a confirmation of this sort of theoretical conjecture that the stable manifold of the unstable pulse serves as a threshold between excitation and decay. I'll finish this part by showing a couple of movies. This movie illustrates what happens to the front when the stimulus amplitude is slightly below or slightly above the threshold. So we'll see this intermediate transient solution for some time before it actually will depart, one to the excitation and this to decay. So for some time it just looked like a propagating pulse, but actually it is unstable, so you see it goes one way or another way. Now this is not particularly surprising. More interesting part of it is that this kind of behavior is universal in the sense that it will be observed as a transient solution whatever initial conditions you start from. In this example there is the same system but very different initial conditions. This is a very wide and small in amplitude. This is very narrow and high in amplitude. In both cases, the amplitude has been chosen with high precision to be very near to the excitation threshold. And so they start very different, but they very soon arrive to the same solution. Well, this solution is not a stable solution. This is an unstable solution. But it's observed the same because it's threshold, and we have chosen the amplitude close to the threshold. Okay, so that's the theory so far. So it's far from completed and it's far from having sort of practically applicable results. So the way we are thinking of developing it is that now that we understand on a mathematical level the structure of the threshold between excitation and decay, we only need to develop an approximation of this stable manifold, and as soon as we do that we'll have an analytical criterion which will tell us which initial conditions will actually initiate propagating wave and which will not. So it's a relatively simple step, but we are not there yet. Well, how good that approximation will be we don't know, but nevertheless approximating a stable manifold codimension one is a known procedure. And hopefully, the theory should be applicable to other kind of protocols where instead of just initial condition, you can have injected current into your fiber or into your fiber and see whether it will initiate propagation. And that probably should do something to do with discontinuous propagation and the ectopic nexus about which Alain Pamir was talking, another interesting phenomena. So it's where it's all directed, but we are not there yet. Did you have a question? Now, if I have another 5 or 10 minutes, I'll do the last bit of it. It's just some other direction that we are doing, the evolution of the spiral waves. This is just a reminder what is a drift of the spiral, and that we can have three-dimensional scroll waves, and they can curve and they can twist and all sorts of things. And there is an asymptotic theory of this various sorts of drifts, not all, but various. For instance, the drift due to homogeneity, the drift due to resonance stimulation, about which Vladimir was talking on Friday, and the slow drift over twisting and bending of the squall waves. This all can be described by asymptotic theory, which is not relying on any small parameters in the kinetics, only on the sort of slowness of the evolution, the gradients and everything. And the equations of motion that you get there have typically this form, the equation of motion for the center of rotation of the spiral, if we're talking about the spirals, and the equation of change of the phase of the spiral. And the results of the right-hand side of those equations can be obtained with these formulas, which I didn't mean to explain at all, only to mention that you do the excitation or the perturbation, whatever perturbation may happen to be, you multiply it by something, which we call response functions, and the answer, and they integrate over the whole space and over a period of time, say. And the result will be the force that will cause the spiral to drift. Now, you need to know this thing. And that thing is the solution of this system of equations. And the solution of this system of equations for Fitzhugh-Nagumo produces this kind of picture. This is the spiral wave as elevation. And the components of the response functions are depicted by the components of the color. And the peculiar thing is that it's located on the tip of the spiral, which means that if you try to influence the movement of the spiral by applying perturbation here, 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 it won't make any effect, but if you apply it here, that it will. That's only true about perturbations, but in principle. So for various equations, that has been solution obtained at various times. For complex Ginzburg-Landau equation, we even checked that the prediction that are done by the theory actually agree with numerical simulations, so the theory can give accurate prediction. That's one of our... So we only recently obtained it for Fitzhugh-Nagumo, that's why I thought of mentioning it here, although for Barclay's model it was obtained earlier. Now, one thing I particularly was keen to show, one method of obtaining response functions, is illustrated here. This is the solution in the form of a spiral wave. Now, what will be shown here is a solution of a linearized adjoint problem solved backwards in time. The blue thing is the solution of the spiral wave, just to see where it is. And the green and red components represent what will eventually be response functions. So what is done here? We take the solution of the spiral wave, we invert it back in time, and we'll solve another equation where that inverted back in time solution is a coefficient, and that equation is linear. And that with the solution of that linear equation emerges as it emerges as the response function. So the same result, again, the response function is localized. Why I thought interesting of mentioning it is because this procedure, just taking linearized operator, adjoining it, and then taking back in time and then solving, can be applied to anything at all, not necessarily to spiral waves. Well, the result of this procedure says, in a common language, is that, well, if you want to control this or affect this solution, whether you call it spiral wave or some other way, you have to perturb it here, but not anywhere else. So it reveals where actually the soft spot or the place where you can actually affect it is located. It's actually localized here. So this thing reveals it. So when you have questions like chicken and egg alternative, when you don't know what actually is driving what, well, I think you can do this thing. And that can be done to any equations at all, if you can linearize it. And solve it back in time, and the answer will be there. And I think on this point I finish. Thank you very much. That's the thanks to all contributing to it. And can't miss this opportunity to advertise two positions that are available. But meanwhile, you may have some questions.
Just a quick question. Relative to the first thing you talked about, these models that are going to be produced by asymptotic methods, if you were to implement those as numerical simulations, do you have any feeling for how they would interact with spatial heterogeneities in particular, this small scale light schedules that they
Well, I know for sure that with small scale they will not interact well, because the assumption is that any dependence on parameters is slow. So if it is not slow, then immediately the fast system is not applicable. You have to solve it again anew on this heterogeneity. That's my expectation.